Make a prompt start. So, delighted to be here. Sorry, introducing this session. Some of you will know that in my day job, I'm doing a piece of work that's looking at networks across policing in the UK in terms of delivering critical police services. So, imagine my disappointment at arriving here to find that the opposition, the criminals, are actually rather better at doing networks perhaps than we are. So this session is going to pick up from yesterday evening's work. We are, though, this time I think, focusing not just on if you like, networks in a sort of abstract way, but looking specifically at how networks based around particular criminal activities can be described and hopefully tackled more effectively. So we have three speakers. Paolo, who is you met last night and is busy loading up his screen. No. Barak is going to be speaking on the West Midlands experience. And I have to say, this piece of work has been very strongly supported by Home Office. It's been incredibly influential in the serious and organised crime review that Home Office have been undertaking for the last year or so. And interesting that Mike showed very briefly in one of his slides organised crime group mapping, because I think this is a methodology that will challenge and hopefully refine the way that that mapping takes place. We then move on to Adam, who is going to talk about marijuana farm slavery, which neatly ties in again with some of Mike's comments. And Andrew is here once again to sort of help any time that we've got to be used productively. So without further ado, Paolo, if you're good to go, we're good to go.
Thank you very much. As you have seen, a lot of cybercrime protection on Google. thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here today. Thanks, Larry. Thanks for the nice, kind words. And thanks for having me. What I want to do very, very shortly, also I'm conscientious of time, well, I've been working on many different type of networks, human trafficking networks, migrant smuggling networks, organized crime networks. Some police forces here in the room have very kindly gave me some data on organized crime in the UK. But what I want to share with you today is one insight from a piece of work I did on human trafficking. Now, it's an interesting insight, I think, because it's telling us some cautionary tale about using network analysis to understand the structure and activities of criminal organizations or criminal rings. And also highlights what we were saying yesterday about the importance of the human, the importance of the human factors. So algorithm and human factors should go hand in hand for the reasons that should be clear in a second. Now, if we look at human trafficking is commonly defined as three successive stages. So you have the recruitment of the victim, you have the transportation of the victim, and then you have the exploitation of the victim. And these three stages come from the UN definition of human trafficking that has been adopted and implemented by 120 plus countries around the world. What I'm going to use today, I'm going to use an example coming from a Nigerian human trafficking ring that was operating between Nigeria and in particular this state called Edo State and its capital, Benin City, and Europe. The destination countries for these particular investigations were the Netherlands and Italy. But the point I want to make today is much more general than that. So you can substitute destination country, Netherlands and Italy, with any destination country you can think of, including the UK. Now, what happens? Victims were recruited in Edo State. They were transported to Europe mostly by plane. In fact, these are pictures of victims, pictures that were taken at airports in Europe. And then at the end of this journey, they encounter the grim reality of the daily exploitation. And this is street prostitution. Now, the trafficking ring behind this investigation that I reconstructed from the court files and the police evidence comes from a two-month period of enhanced international surveillance. So what the police did, they followed the victims during these 2 months. And during these 2 months, 33 victims were trafficked by 25 offenders in 16 trafficking events, because victims sometimes travel together, so you have more victims associated to one event, and also more offenders. So based on this, I build the network, and it's a two-mode network we saw yesterday with Andrew. The yearly estimate is around 200 victims, so this is a fairly large trafficking ring. Now, what I did in my work, I ran some analysis, and I shown that there is a clear division of labor within the trafficking ring. So you have people who specialize in transportation, and then you have people who specialize in exploitation. I run a number of models in the network to explain, in the paper, to explain why A and B have established a link and not B and C. So based on a number of variables that you can see here, for instance, sharing the same nationality, the age, whether they had a kinship tie, whether they had the same role, whether they have they were connected to the same trafficking stage. And this is the bit that tells you that people in two different trafficking stages tend not to cooperate. There is much more to it and many more models, but this is not the focus of the presentation today. I'm very happy to send you the paper with all the fancy statistical models. What I want to show you today is the network. So this is the network behind this trafficking ring. And you see these are the people, the offenders involved. Some of them have more interactions, so the higher level of interaction, the thick the line. Some people are central in the network, just structurally central. The algorithm draws them close together to the center. Others are peripheral. The relative position of the dots is meaningful. Now, if you open a textbook on network analysis, the first thing people tell you is to look at the degree centrality, meaning the number of actors any given actor is connected to. The highest the number of actors, the more central a person is in terms of the degree centrality. The next thing that the book on disrupting criminal networks tells you is that central people are the one you should go after. Because, well, they are often called like the key players. So are the people who are running the show, the Mr. Big. The people at the periphery are less important. So indeed, you see here a very clear core of people there with a very large dot. The larger the dot, the highest the degree centrality. Often we look at a second measure called betweenness centrality, which is a measure of brokerage. So the number of people who have to go through me to get in touch with any other person in the network. This measure is important. Degree centrality is also important in certain circumstances. This is important if we want to, for instance, look at the flow of information. People with high between the centralities always make for good informants, for instance. So if you want to recruit an informant, between the centrality is a good measure. But what about this specific network? Well, here you see the same people are very set. The two people at the center are also very high in between the centrality. So textbook approach the core is pretty clear, and you have a clear periphery. And here is the thing. But what do these people do? So far we have looked at structural properties. But what are these people doing in the network? Well, the people at the center, they are all involved in the transportation stage. The people at the periphery, they tend to be involved in the exploitation stage. Now, you see a clear difference between the center and the periphery. They specialize in different things. And here starts to be clear that actually there are two possible routes and two possible strategies. And the two strategies are not the same thing. They are not equivalent. You can either target the transporters if you go for the center. So let me put it this way. If you target the center, you target the transporters only. If you go for the periphery, you target the exploiters. Well, that is an extra layer, which kind of changes the entire picture and the entire strategy. But there is more. If we plot the place where these people operate, you see that there is a difference between the exploiters that tend to operate and being embedded, entrenched in a local community in the destination country, and the transporters that tend to operate outside the destination country. In some cases, some of them operated outside the European Union, so the Dutch authorities and the Italian authorities couldn't rely on the European arrest warrant, for instance. So it changes again the strategies and the tools. But this is actually interesting. So when you bring the place in and you bring the mechanisms in, the activities in, things become slightly more complex or nuanced, if you like. So whom to target? When I always ask whom to target, well, the textbook will say high centrality actors. However, if you target the high centrality actors, you will find yourself targeting A, only transporters, B, actors that are highly mobile, and actors that are very far from the local police force. In addition, when you look at the file and you look at the mechanisms, you see that the transporters are responding to a demand coming from the exploiters. So the exploiters that are at the periphery, structurally at the periphery, organizationally or from the working perspective of the network, are actually very central. Because it's them who go to the transporter and you say, okay, I pay you 10,000 euros in this case, can you bring this victim? So if you take the transporters out, what happens? Well, there will be another transporters. Pretty easily. So that doesn't strike me as a very good strategy, or it's a strategy that can bear fruits, but it's very, very difficult. On the other side, the good old community policing will probably help much more, considering that the exploiters are there, embedded in the community. Everybody knows who the madams are in the case of Nigerian human trafficking. And it's them who create the demand. So they create the conditions for the network to continue. So to conclude, what are the lessons from this very brief talk about this specific case? Well, people that appear as structurally peripheral might, on the contrary, play a key role when we consider the modus operandi of a network. So activities, what people do, and the mechanisms underpinning the network are as important as a structure. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of times the degree centrality, the between the centralities are perfectly fine. It's just that we need to know when they are okay and when they're not okay. And the only way we can do it is by having a constant exchange between, for instance, the analyst and the officers with knowledge of the case. So knowledge of the mechanism, the context. it's always this back and forth between people from with different type of knowledge and expertise that can give us the right answer. And the last point is that, which I think is particularly nice given the audience, is that even in a case that is generally truly transnational, well, local policing still matters. The exploiters are there. Local policing matters at the end, and local policing matters at the beginning in Benin City. Now, since there are no representatives of the police forces from Benin City, I talked to the police forces at the end of the continuum. It's still relevant. Your work, what you do, what the tradition of community policing, getting information on the ground and attacking from the end, is still very relevant. Thank you.
Hello, good morning everybody. I'll present to you the results of a randomized controlled trial in which we implemented and used this kind of technology, this kind of advanced science in social network analysis. The results are quite promising and interesting as well. There are a lot of lessons learned from an operational perspective as well as theory. This is a joint collaboration with John Denley, who's a PhD candidate at the Institute of Criminology. So the background to what you're about to see here is an experiment that we've conducted in Sacramento, California. And it was another project that was conducted with a student of ours at the MST program. And you'll see the design in just a minute. And the idea is relatively simple on paper. The idea is, what happens if we go and try to target prolific offenders with two aims? The first aim is to see what happens when police contact these offenders with an aim to prevent them from committing more crime. And then to see the effect of these interactions with their co-offenders. So that's the model that you see in front of you. And the idea behind this is to go to target specific prolific offenders and compare their criminal behavior within the randomized controlled trial platform and compare that to control prolific offenders. But we were really interested to see what would happen to their co-offenders, and we did nothing with the co-offenders. And importantly, the intervention was a one-off meeting. So all officers had to do was to go and talk to this prolific offender, if they could find them, and that was an implementation problem, and I'm going to come back to that in just a second, and to see what happens if this one chat leads to a reduction in their arrests, in their criminal behavior. And as you can see here, it actually worked. Now, I'm kind of passing things through because I don't have a lot of time, but this is really important findings. It suggests that when police officers talk to offenders, it has an impact. It's not just a wishy-washy sort of, yeah, they ignore us. No, it has an effect. The difference between a regular contact between the police officers and offenders is that normally the contact comes after a crime. So you arrest somebody for a particular offense. Here, it basically came out of nowhere. Based on our social network analysis, we understood that these offenders committed a lot of crime, the prolific offenders, and we wanted to talk to them ahead of any other crime. And the point is that they didn't know what we know. So they were at risk now because they did not know how much information we hold against them, and they may have thought that this is too risky to commit crime in the follow-up period, and that's the reason we're seeing a 20% reduction in arrests. Interestingly enough, we've also found a reduction of about 13% in the arrests of the co-offenders, the people around them that are connected through social networks and were arrested with them in the past, and their criminality went down as well. In other words, the message passes. The message passes on. Now, we didn't measure the passage of the message, but we measured behavioral changes, and then we saw a reduction in arrests in that group as well. So West Midlands Police said, can we do the same? And the answer is no. The reason why we cannot do the same, which I'm going to come back to a little bit in a minute, is that their prolific offenders and the ones that they wanted to talk about, the OCGs, the organized crime members, are already under a lot of surveillance. There's a lot of focus on them already. So adding another intervention is just adding one more thing that perhaps is not going to be as effective, and of course, you have the interaction effect. You have different kinds of treatments happening at the same time, so it's difficult to measure the effect that we wanted to look at. So instead we said, why don't we take a different approach? Why don't we take an approach that will be tailored for organized crime groups in West Midlands Police, but instead of focusing on pursuit, instead of focusing on the organized crime members, why don't we try to focus on the peripheries, on the offenders around the OCG members, around the organized crime groups, and try to prevent them from entering this world of criminality? And the fact of the matter is, using arrest is not the best option out there, because you cannot arrest your problem out of it. If you look at the West Midlands Police data, most OCG members are not in prison. They're not inside the system. In other words, arrest by itself doesn't seem to have that impact of reducing crime overall. So instead, we've taken a prevent approach, which comes from the counterterrorism arena. I'll talk about it later if we have some time. But it's trying to prevent people from entering this particular world. And that's where this research came about. It's called Operation Jigsaw. So if you implement the triple T, which I think is becoming a standard sort of like a cookbook for us in how to conduct experiments and understand evidence-based policing. So we looked at the three stages of targeting these offenders, testing through a randomized controlled trial methodology, and then tracking if it's actually happening or not. So in terms of the targeting, the people that we should target, we wanted to look at people that we can prevent them from entering this particular world, which I will show you in just a second. And because of the sheer size, you know, ROKU is a different regional organized crime units. It's a little bit different than neighborhood policing and other policing tactics, because they don't have the funding issues that most of you have. So it was really cool because we had a large experiment and we could have done a lot of things with it. Not unlimited resources, but we can do many things. So they said, okay, why don't we test different kinds of treatments? Different things came up, but the two main ones that we wanted to test were police-led prevention initiatives, and the other one is third sector prevent interventions. These are the NGOs that come in and try to help out. And then in terms of the tracking, we wanted to make sure that we have a very rigid, very robust way of measuring whether the intervention was indeed implemented. So the targeting tool and the targeting instrument that we've used was the OCGM tracker, or the Organized Crime Members Tracker. It's not perfect. Everybody here that has some link into the OCG tracker knows that it's not the most valid tool out there. We tried different things, but they said we insist on using something that's already in-house. It's something that we want to implement that we've already done before. We don't want to rock the boat completely, so we want to do something that people are used to, so the OCG tracker was kind of the default that we wanted to use. But through this organized crime tracker, we were able to map out this world, to see how people link to one another, and most importantly, to see who are their links, who are these people that they commit offenses with, but are not recognized as part of the organized crime family, if you will. So in order to understand how many people we should treat, we went backwards. We first said, okay, how many officers can we second to this project? How many people can actually do the treatment? And they said, well, we can actually treat about 220 people. And based on that, we went backwards to understand how many cases and who are the people that would be eligible for this particular intervention. We had some eligibility criteria, exclusion criteria, so no kids. And as you can see, just a minute, these people are quite older. No persons that were deemed too dangerous, quote unquote. I don't exactly know how to operationalize too dangerous, but that individuals that the intelligence community said don't touch them, that they're under other sorts of interventions, and they're deemed too risky to be part of this experiment. And individuals that already been under a particular treatment were excluded as well. But we were still left with about 2,200. Offenders that fit this eligibility. And I see you all watching the video and not paying attention to me, so I'll just pass on by. So how does it look? We're all about social networks right now, as you can see. So how does it look? So every red dot you see here is essentially an organized crime group member. This is one particular group. I should have mentioned, and I will mention more in just a second, that we're actually looking at the organized crime group as the unit of analysis. And the reason why we're doing this is because if we want to have an intervention, we don't want to have a spillover of the treatment effect from one person to the next. So that would be critical. But anyway, here every red dot is the member, and the blue dots are the target group. We'll call them target group. And these are the people in the periphery that are not the OCG members, but are committing a lot of crimes. In terms of the experiment, an RCT, of course, we love experiments. And again, the spillover issue is a big one, is a major one. I know that scholars in the social network analysis community are very intrigued by the way messages pass on between members or between actors, but we need to watch out. Because let's say that these two are two offenders, and he's a treatment offender, and he's a control offender, they might be talking to one another, so he's going to contaminate him. So that's not good for us. So that's the reason why we looked at the entire group as the unit of analysis. I'll skip that. There's nothing interesting to say about this. But there are two, as I said, there are two treatments that we try to do. One is a police-led, and one is a private sector-led. And we wanted to run it for about a year. And I'll say in a minute why we wanted to run it for a year and why the plans have changed a bit. So at the end of this project, at the end of this process of knowing whom to target, Paula said it nicely, whom to target, we had 60 OCG groups, organized crime groups, with 235 members-ish, with a police-led group with about 50 groups and 220 prolific offenders, and the third sector group with about 220, so relatively the same. So what have we found? The first message is a bit disappointing, but an important one. We were not able to rely on third-party charities. And the reason why we were not able to rely on them is because they wanted to cream our cases. In other words, they were not up for an RCT. They said, we wanted to choose the cases we want to treat. We want to select the cases that will fit our eligibility criteria, and then we will measure our success ourselves. And we said, we can't have that. We need to tell you whom to target. We need to tell you what the list is about. You cannot decide who are the best cases for you to treat, because, of course, then the program will be very successful. Now, I understand why they do it, but on the other hand, it's not a fair comparison to the control group or to the police group, and that's the reason why we had to drop that. Of course, we kept on trying, and we had another provider, and they set up all these group sessions on weekends, and they tried several weeks, but in all these weeks, only one offender turned up. It may have been the day, it could have been that Saturday is not a good day for these interventions, but at the end of the day, we had to drop this group all together. So then we're left with police-led groups and group and the control group, and you can see some of their baseline statistics, in other words, comparing between the two, so that kind of proves the point that the random assignment worked. The two groups are quite comparable to one another in terms of the mean age, the ones that were born in Birmingham, and the total arrest. These are pretty serious guys in terms of their offending behavior. I mean, these are a lot of arrests compared to the general offending population. So that was in terms of the target group. Now the vicarious effect, in other words, the OCG members, and that's really an interesting group. About 118 OCG members in the control group, 106 in the police-led one, out of 2,200 eligible cases. So it's just a relatively small sample. They are comparable to one another. There's a bit of a difference in terms of their offending pattern over here, as you can see, but that was not statistically significant because we have a lot of variation between them. In other words, the two groups are comparable to one another in this sense as well. Bottom line, random assignment worked. The magic of random assignment actually worked. So what did we find, bottom line? It's funny, we present for 10 minutes for just one slide, right? So what do we find for the target population in terms of recidivism? A 57% reduction in arrests. So you might say to yourself, I'm not impressed by these figures, 22 versus 55, well, hold on. This is a before minus the after. So it's comparing the year before versus the year of the after. So you shouldn't see too much of a difference between them, so in terms of the one minus the other. But bear in mind that this is an experiment. This is not all OCG members and all organized crime groups in West Mids or around the country. So this is indicative of a process of what happens if you would blow it up to try to implement this across across the country. So you're not falling off your seats, but I'll say it anyway, a 57% reduction in arrests. That's quite whopping. That's really interesting. But that's not the most, I think that's not the most interesting result of this experiment. The more interesting result of this experiment, in my mind, is what happened to the organized crime members. Now remember, this is a project about prevention. We get that. That's the reason why the Home Office was really interested in this. But we wanted to see what happens to the organized crime members, what happens to their behavioral patterns. And we found a 25% increase in their offending, that is, the treatment group, the vicarious effect on the treated, was that they had more arrests compared to the control. So you look at this and like, what happened? Why is that the case? Well, actually it made a lot of sense. First of all, if you break down the pattern in terms of the types of offenders within the organized crime groups, and everybody here in the UK would know the differences between these different four different sort of categories. So we have the principled subjects, the head honcho, the big guy, right? And then we have the significant group members, and then we have the ones in the periphery, and the ones that are part of the group, but we don't really know based on intelligence to assign them any level of risk or where exactly they sit in this story. And as you can see, the real increase in their behavior, in their arrest behavior is, in other words, criminal behavior, sorry, is the significant group and the peripheral group subjects, about a 43% increase and a 31% increase for that group. Why is that the case? What happened? Well, if you have nobody to go to, if you don't have nobody to carry the drugs, if you have nobody to pass on the weapons, somebody has to do it. And because these offenders were under surveillance anyway, they got picked up. They were arrested. Because now you're under surveillance, you do something bad, you get caught. They didn't have the people around them to actually do all these things for them. So they had to do it themselves. So their arrest records went up. So it's a nice quote. I can't believe that, you know, Bush nowadays seems reasonable in these days, but let's leave it outside the discussion right now. So, final points about tracking of outputs. This is really important. We really are a lot about tracking these days because it's so essential. And we found that about 78% of the targets had the initial contact. It means that 22% weren't able to reach them, which kind of makes sense in a way because these are chaotic people. They are offenders. We have the last known address here, but next week they live somewhere else. So it's really difficult to find them, but the teams did really well in that sense. I must say, the team members, and the officers that were delivering this intervention were very much against this. And they were against this not because of the organizational framework or politics. They said, we go to these guys, we knock on their doors. Some of them say F you, some of them don't open the door. And some of them say, what are you talking about? I'm out of the game. You came to the wrong person. Yeah, I was arrested with that person a couple of years ago, but that I'm not in it anymore. Well, the numbers don't lie to that extent, because at the end of the day, they're offended less, and we see this in their arrest record. So when you have a contact with the offender, you seem to believe that there's nothing there, because he told you everything is fine, and I'm married, and everything is fine. But the numbers actually tell a different story. And then after the initial meeting, they had additional meetings. So they had what we called the pathways contact. So just about 50% of them had that additional contact. And then about 25% of them actually required support or guidance further down the line. And because we tracked everything with tablets and we had all this beautiful technology, so officers had the technology to, and we have exactly when they made the contact with whom and so on, and who was in the room, and really a large number of variables, if you want qualitative variables about the contact. So you can see that actual education, training, and employment seems to lead the way in terms of what kind of help these people need. It wasn't really about drugs as much as accommodation and employment and training. So bottom line, the third sector provision of help wasn't successful. I don't want to generalize because it's not an RCT. We didn't randomly assign different groups, but it seems to be discouraging to see that they weren't able to help us in this end because we really wanted to work with them. The social network analysis worked in the sense that the OCG tracker, it's not perfect. I'm sure there are better models out there to predict who's more likely to commit crime and have better information, but it's not the worst tool out there. In terms of the messages that we've delivered, in terms of the intervention itself, I didn't spend too much time about what the intervention was about. It was essentially a one-on-one conversation with the offender and trying to tell him, watch out, we're onto you. So it's a deterrence message. But also, here's a way for you to get some help. So it's a mixture of both interventions at the same time. And it seems to be effective, and that's the reason why we're seeing a reduction in the arrests. But we're also seeing an increase in arrests in the OCG members. And that's interesting by itself because we understand this is they needed somebody else to commit crime for them, and that's the reason why they got picked up. So that's it for me. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Adam Ramirez. I'm a detective sergeant with Surrey Police. When I was thinking of a thesis topic for my research, I wanted to do something that was new and that's something that hadn't been explored before in much detail at all. At the time, I was working as a staff officer for Surrey Police, and the force was becoming increasingly concerned in relation to modern-day slavery and human trafficking. I initially wanted to potentially use the Cambridge Crime Harm Index to apply that to modern slavery cases. It was difficult for me to do that, and the reason for that was this was a crime type that was very obscure, not very well understood at all. So the advice I was given at the time was to concentrate on a slice. In our force, cannabis farms regularly crop up, and I decided to focus on those as my units of analysis. And the reason for that as well was an area which wasn't very well explored in terms of research at all. First of all, just so people understand what they are, if you do not know, this is a picture of a typical cannabis farm. A large amount of cannabis plants, the heating and lighting equipment, a large cannabis yield, which can be highly profitable for the organised crime groups that are believed to control these places. Often they involve a grower or growers who live and work within the residential premises itself where these farms are growing. In terms of my research questions, previous research did suggest that there was a link between modern slavery and cannabis farms. There's a real dearth of literature, a real lack of literature. But there was recent research by a chap called Berland, which suggested that a very large amount of commercial cannabis farm cases involving Vietnamese growers ended up in convictions and deportation, even when there was compelling evidence of human trafficking and forced labour. But that had just not been picked up throughout the criminal justice system at all, including when the police officers and the police initially dealt with these cases. And there was a lack of research as to why that was the case, which warranted further research, further discussion. And therefore, I developed these research questions. To what extent do the police tend to presume that growers arrested on cannabis farms should be treated primarily as suspects under drug laws rather than as victims of enslavement? And what evidence, if any, is there that as a consequence, enforcement of cannabis production laws has failed to detect slavery victims? In terms of my data, I did a very brief piece of initial quantitative analysis. I focused on the Vietnamese community, and the reason for that was that the information from the National Police Chiefs Council is that cannabis farms tend to be controlled or involved with the Vietnamese community itself. In terms of the initial quantitative analysis I did, looking at the Vietnamese growers from a three-year period in Surrey and Sussex Police, I looked at their criminal backgrounds. It was a very mixed picture. The vast majority of them did not have any criminal convictions at all, but some of them did. They had harmful criminal convictions for offences such as grievous bodily harm. In terms of case identification, what I wanted to do was focus on a few cases because these cannabis farms are not very well understood academically at all. So the idea was to pick a few cases and to look at them in great, great depth. Rigorous case studies involving looking at the raw police materials themselves, as well as then conducting semi-structured interviews with the growers themselves, as well as police officers. And I was influenced by Mr. Barton as well in a tweet that he made some time ago saying we can't just measure things, we need more stories as well. In terms of ethics, I know I'm a bit short of time, there were massive ethical considerations for me in relation to my research. I spent a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of thinking in relation to them. I haven't got time to go into the depths of those now, but that was very demanding for me as well. I know that this is very small scale research. It's not a massive statistical piece. I only looked at three cases. I make no claim whatsoever that they are generalisable to every single cannabis farm case, but it may be that they're indicative of some other stuff that's going on. I'll cover the three cases briefly. In terms of the first case study, this involved a Vietnamese national, and he'd been identified by way of DNA at a crime scene. Cannabis cultivation and immigration offences had been recorded, but when this chap was interviewed in police custody, he made no claim of victimisation at all. He just described his journey, having been smuggled over from Vietnam, and the work that he had been doing at the house. The police interviewer and the officer in charge of the investigation as well believed that he was simply a suspect in relation to drugs offences. But interestingly, there had been a national referral mechanism referral made, and that's the referral that the police can make to the National Crime Agency when there is a concern in relation to human trafficking and modern slavery. However, there was no real exploration of that in relation to the police investigation itself. It was very perfunctory. Yet when I spoke to this individual in prison and interviewed him at length, he gave me a very compelling narrative of modern slavery and human trafficking. He'd been smuggled out of the country. He had to leave for political reasons. And it was a very tortuous journey that he made up, including through Russia. The group he was with was subjected to real extreme violence. And then when he was in England working in the cannabis farm, it was solitary confinement, threats of abuse, threats of death, malnourishment, solitary confinement. It sounded like a really really appalling existence that he led. In terms of the second case study itself, it was rather similar. It was another Vietnamese national. Again, the police had recorded cannabis cultivation and immigration offences. This man made no claim of victimisation in custody whatsoever at all. He answered no comment to all of his interviews in his police interview. And when the police were questioning him, there was no real exploration of any potential modern-day slavery at all. Yet when I spoke to him, again, there was a very compelling narrative of potential modern-day slavery. And these individuals as well, I should add, they hadn't made this victimisation claim before. They were being deported. There was nothing for them to gain, really, in terms of, you know, suddenly making a plea of victimisation because the decisions had already been made. But he did give me a compelling narrative of modern-day slavery as well, similar to the previous man that I've spoken to as well. Debt bondage, threats, malnourishment, solitary confinement. In terms of him and his status, he said he wasn't sure whether he was a victim. Whereas the first person, and I forgot to say this, he said, "I'm not a victim." He said, "I volunteered to go to the UK. I volunteered, that was a voluntary decision, so I can't be considered a victim." And a national referral mechanism referral has now gone in relation to this man, and decision is awaited. In terms of the third and final case study, this was an Albanian gentleman. And the reason it was an Albanian man was I found it very difficult to identify growers to interview. The reason for that was most of them have been deported. So I went to where I could get the evidence. This had been dealt with by the police in terms of a cannabis cultivation offence. Again, no claim of victimisation in police custody. Another no comment interview, perhaps due to the legal advice this man had been given, I don't know. Again, no modern-day slavery crime report was created. It was very much treated as a drugs case alone. Very perfunctory questioning around modern-day slavery. It was interesting because the police officer himself said to me that he had very substantial private concerns regarding potential trafficking, but he just hadn't formalised that in terms of the police investigation. Yet again, this was a compelling narrative about modern-day slavery, smuggling to begin with, and when the gentleman had not been able to pay his money and pay his debt, then the agents, as he referred to them, really applied the pressure and eventually said to him, "You have to work for us, you're going to work here," and he was confined in a cannabis house. To generalise some of my findings then, any exploration of modern day slavery regarding these cases by the police was perfunctory at best, and the onus was very much on a cannabis grower to divulge their own victimisation. Yet the growers did not tend to do that in custody. A range of abuses were described by these cannabis growers that I spoke to. There was traditional kind of concepts of modern-day slavery and trafficking. One of the individuals was physically locked inside the house. The other two were technically free to leave, but due to the threats that they were subjected to, they didn't feel that they were able to. I also thought that the cases demonstrated like a transition from smuggling to trafficking, which Dr. Campana talked about in 2015 in one of his papers, whereby an individual can agree to be smuggled, but their smuggling can transform to trafficking for different reasons, including where the nature of the work that they're going to be doing in the country of their destination is withheld from them, and then they're forced into criminality. I think in terms of framing, I think the police tend to frame these cases along traditional lines, drugs cases, and there isn't that broader thinking, is what I found. And in none of these cases was there any formal identification of any slavery victims. I think there is still a general ignorance on the part of the police as to the extent of modern-day slavery and trafficking. In terms of policy implications, I've put these under three broad headings here. I think there does need to be an improvement in terms of training regarding modern-day slavery. I think there are real investigative opportunities for the police, especially in the initial early stages of an investigation at the scene. And I think also in terms of abusers, you know, where there are victims, there are abusers. And that's why it's so important for some of that detailed network analysis to be done. And I've just identified a few areas for further research here. Why does the CPS authorise and pursue criminal prosecutions against cannabis growers who may well be victims of modern-day slavery? How can the criminal justice system ethically manage modern-day slavery victims who are also illegal immigrants? Thirdly, who are the organised criminals behind cannabis farms and how do they operate? And lastly, as new crime types emerge, how are these interpreted by police policy makers? And for my final slide here, I went to Florence for a bit of a break during my research period, and I saw this sculpture by Michelangelo, and it's one of his four slaves. And I just found it interesting. It reminded me of the cannabis growers that I had interviewed in terms of it's an unfinished sculpture. Michelangelo didn't finish it. The slave is obscured, hidden, and trapped. It reminds me of the cannabis growers, and it might be indicative of the state of modern-day slavery in the UK today. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you to all our speakers. You've had some art, you've had some science.